Hello there. Hanging out in a humid climate, it's me, Michelle Cortins. On today's episode of the Orchard Outlook podcast, we're finally putting the spotlight on the most economically significant apple fungal disease. You guessed it, apple scab. Would this even be an apple orchard podcast without an episode on apple scab? That's an existential question that luckily, now we don't need to answer. The point is, in the orchard, scab is caused by pathogens that are endemic, everywhere, and looming over us. Don't panic. We've got just the person to tackle this topic, a passionate pathologist. In my email communications, I shared with them changes to fungicide restrictions in Canada, and they sympathize with us folks, to the point of passing along the information to others. In his active research, he might be said to be interrupting infections, conquering conidia, and modeling maniacally. So now, let's welcome our guest, Dr. Surgeon Achimovich. Hello, Surgeon.
Hey, how you doing, Michelle?
Good, how are you?
Good.
So first, from your plant pathology perspective, are you looking forward to spring coming, or are you in denial that it's coming?
Yeah, so I mentioned to you earlier, we are a month ahead here from where I used to work. So it is a little bit of a challenge, but I would say that I'm in between denial and getting ready. It's definitely coming ahead. You know, we're about 0.5% of green tip right now for some early varieties like Gala.
Oh, wow. Okay, you've already got green tissue showing. So this is very relevant, this conversation for you.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So where is your lab located and kind of what's the focus of your research?
Sure. So my lab is located at Virginia Tech's Agricultural and Research Extension Center in Winchester, Virginia. So the lab is focusing on tree fruit and specialty crop diseases, with, of course, lion's share of that responsibility being on apple and a little bit of peaches and maybe cherries. My primary focus of research is on apple fire blight, which is caused by Ravinia malvarea, a really devastating disease, as of course you know. And we are also focusing on apple bitter rot a lot in research. We have had a lot of issues with this disease in the past, and it seems to me that a lot of growers, you know, keep on having issues on the East Coast with this disease. So those are the two primary ones, but we also do a lot of efficacy trials. And in that scope, we are not bound only to fire blight and bitter rot. We, you know, work with anything from apple scab to rust to powdery mildew, even Marcellina leaf blotch and stuff like that.
Okay, so lots on your plate for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and to set the stage for the rest of our conversation, could you start by explaining what organism is responsible for apple scab infections and where it's lurking in the orchard?
Sure. So apple scab is caused by a plant pathogenic fungus called Venturia inequalis. This fungus is interesting because it is one of the most important pathogens, you know, in the history of all of the plant diseases. It is causing really huge economical losses. It can reach, up to 70% of fruit loss. And this fungus is really primarily present in the leaf litter or on the orchard floor during the winter. And spring, that's where the pathogen overwinters. It basically forms its sexual structures in the leaf, in the dead leaf tissue. And basically those structures are, you know, small pear fruit-like bodies. They have like a volcano opening on the top. These bodies are called peritesia, and they are developed as initials in the fall when the leaves drop. But then they keep, lingering in that stage of being initials. And then in the spring, these initials start differentiating. And sometime right about now, at least in Virginia here, or when the fruit buds start developing, we get these initials progress in their development and differentiation. And we have formation of inside of the spores called ascospores. They are the product of sexual reproduction, and they cause primary infections in spring. So the primary source of inoculum is leaf litter on the orchard floor. But, you know, in literature, there is also reports about the ability of the fungus to survive under the bud scales in buds. And especially that happens in regions of the world where we have mild winters, mild, like temperatures during the winter. But it's not really a, you know, a severe source of inoculum. And if, you know, there is a good sanitation protocol or a good fungicide program that was applied previous year, it's really a minor, almost a negligent possibility, that can happen. Primarily, it's the leaves on the orchard floor.
Okay, so we've got leaves on the orchard floor that have scab inoculum. Why do temperature and leaf wetness duration then determine if a scab infection occurs?
Yes, so the spores, the ascospores that I mentioned to you before, they have specific requirements for infection. And those requirements are specific, as you mentioned, the amount of leaf wetness, meaning the number of hours that are necessary, and they work in conjunction with temperature. You know, so for instance, ascospores do require presence of water. So they have to be immersed in water or water film to germinate. So if they don't have water, no matter what the temperature is, they can't germinate. So if you have water and a suitable temperature, and temperature can range anywhere from 6 Celsius to 26 Celsius, that's a range in which the germination can happen if the water is present. Those are just basically biological requirements of this fungus. And, going into a little bit of fundamentals, why is this the case? We really don't know exactly, except, certain biological requirements of reorganisms are like that, and certain enzymes function at certain temperatures. But, going back to the more, practical aspect of it, let's put it this way. If you have lower temperatures, the fungus requires more hours of leaf wetness or wetness in which the spores are immersed to allow the infection to progress. So the spores germinate, and if there is no water, they will not be able to continue producing that infection hyphae that is a product of germination. That the infection hyphae needs to be immersed in water, and then it progresses to punctuate, to pierce the leaf cuticle and then cause the infection. And of course, people have been working on apple scab for a long time, and the famous Mills and LaPlante apple scab chart, which shows exactly how many hours of leaf wetness is necessary at which temperature to allow infection, is pretty much well determined. And then it has been upgraded through the years and decades by different scientists, and of course incorporated in different models. So for instance, if we would look at certain cases, for instance, at, 24 Celsius, you would need about 21 hours of leaf wetness to allow really a strong infection, and, 14 hours maybe to make a, mid a strong infection or like a medium infection period. Whereas if you have maybe something like 7 Celsius, you would need about 40 hours to have a strong infection. So that's pretty much the way how there is this interplay between a leaf wetness and the temperature. Some scientists in the last 25, 30 years have been working also on determining, really how the temperature of water itself in which the spores are immersed influences the spores to germinate. And different new models or the upgraded models for prediction, which we're going to talk about later, they basically have incorporated these things into their models to have a better prediction of this disease or infection periods.
Okay, so going back to the heavy infection that you mentioned, there's like a light, moderate, heavy infection. Is that referring to the number of successful spores that germinate?
So during each wetting event, we have a certain number of spores that are being released, right? And they're not like, it's not like we are having 50 or 60 or 70 or 80, 90% of the ascospores of the whole reserve of ascospores released. It's certain amounts of ascospores are being released. And that's evolutionarily designed, of course, that way within the pathogen's, genetics to allow these small percentage of ascospores being released with every wetting event. So basically, biologically, the pathogen does not mature all of a sudden, right? It's protected. So with each rain event, you can have anywhere from, a very small amount of spores released up to almost 3, 5, 7%. Sometimes even like more like 15 or 20% of ascospores released. And going back to your question, basically those cohorts or groups of spores, they are the ones that are exposed to certain temperature at that certain specific time or the wedding event. And it can be completely different conditions for the spores that have been ejected early on in the rain event. And there can be completely different conditions for the ascospores that have been released at the end of that rain event. So that's quite something that has been investigated in the last 30 years, as I mentioned to you before, by European scientists, where they basically found out there's that difference. There's the difference on these spores. So their stories, the stories of these spores, how they germinate, what kind of conditions they have, they are different. And that's actually captured in this new model for AppleScab prediction, which is called RIMPRO. It's basically not, RIMPRO is not just one model for AppleScab, it's a cluster of different models, so TreeFruit. But we just are used to calling it here RIMPRO scab model. And it has the ability to do exactly what you just mentioned, to follow the destinies of these groups of spores with specific focus on specific conditions to happen in that specific hour. And I have not seen anything like that so far. And yes, you're right. These specific conditions that happen even during every hour, they have different impact on these different groups of spores.
Okay. And so are ascospores released in the nighttime? And if so, are they at concerning levels?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot of information online you can find about that not being the case, that the spores do not release during the night. But actually, it's not true. You do get a certain small levels of ascospores being released during the night. They're not, the amounts are not really high in comparison to what you would really see during the day. But still, these amounts are can work like accumulating drops of water in a bucket, right? They can accumulate, they can have some influence. As I mentioned to you before, the RIMPRO AppleScab model has the ability to follow these groups of spores, even during the night, which are released. And the reason why that matters is, even though the amounts of spores are negligent, it's very small, now they can really help the infection when the light starts, when the infection starts, from these spores that are released during the day, they kind of cumulatively work with these small amounts of spores that are released during the night. And the only model that can accommodate or actually show that is the RIMPRO model. And basically now with this model, we have much better ability to see how that night release of the ascospores, very small amounts of ascospores are released during the night, how that influences on the infection later during the day, which we have not had that before. And that's the beauty of that dynamic model that RIMPRO has that follows these groups of spores released at different time. But by and large, it's small amount of spores, but it does have some influence on the overall severity of the scab infection.
Okay, good to know. And could you explain what happens to the ascospores when, say, a rain discharges them, but then the leaves end up drying before the period of time required for an infection?
The prevailing, of course, literature indicates to us that each stage in the life of the ascospores really has certain specific temperatures. Leaf wetness requirements that require that. So in this specific regard, when the ascospores start to germinate and if they are immersed in water, if there is drying sooner than what is anticipated, a certain number of spores are going to be able to infect. And that's why you see that breakdown of that Millicentinal plant chart for AppleScab, where you're going to have a very weak infection if the drying occurs earlier than what would allow maybe a stronger infection. So there's biologically, in biology, 2 + 2 is never 4, right? So these organisms are built that way that they have variability within them so that can secure survival. And in this specific case, when we have certain small spores are going to be, small amount of spores are going to be able to infect, and that's why we call it a low infection scenario. But the majority of spores, if the drying occurs, are gonna basically just that infection hyphae is going to dry and it's not going to be able to progress and infect successfully. And again, going back to the upgrades in the models that predict apple scab, that's what also RIMPRO's model is able to show. It is able to show the amounts of spores that are being released in that model. And it's also being able to show if the conditions were not conducive for the infection to happen. Primarily, the main reason, again, is not only the amount of water and drying, it's the temperature as well. Sometimes you can have water, but it can be very cold. And the even though the spores maybe have been released, but then you have a cold period coming after that, the germinating spores are not gonna continue infecting or not gonna establish the infection because there's just not enough warmth for the pathogen to infect.
So the hyphae would be growing really slowly and
yes, they would just cease in their development because, as I mentioned to you before, certain enzymes and certain proteins that allow certain biological processes to go, they're highly dependent on temperature. Many, many different plant pathogens, of course, are bound to temperature a lot, that's a primary driver. So yes, you're correct. There's going to be that infection hyphae is going to just basically die because of that prolonged exposure to cold temperature. Or if there's a lack of water, it's going to desiccate and not cause the infection.
Okay. So what happens if leaves get re-wetted with a follow-up rain period?
That's a great question. So it really depends how many hours has passed from the time when the desiccation first occurred. To be honest with you, that's a little bit more of a gray zone there. There might have been some work done in that regard that maybe has not been published, but the jury is still out there how much of time, you require to allow, for these desiccated, infection hyphae to maybe be re-wetted and allow infection to occur. But, let's say in general, if you had a very brief time when you had drying and then, during the, maybe there was really strong winds that allowed really quickly drying of the leaves. But then in, maybe 2-3 hours after that, there was, rain that occurred again, and then, probably there's going to be some, rejuvenation or some ability of the fungus to infect really quickly. And, there are rules in which we know how many, what is the time span that basically we can apply that, these two infection periods maybe can be just merging to a one. But, with new knowledge that has come from European scientists in the last 30 years, as I mentioned to you through that RIMPRO model, we now actually see that certain infection periods can be really discerned really, clearly. And then, that one infection period and then drying and then the other infection period can be actually now separated. Whereas before we would kind of merge them into one big infection period. Well, and that's because of that additional research that has been done on really following exactly from hour to hour, how these conditions impact certain, specific, growth stages in the ascospore life from the moment of discharge to the moment of infection and basically germination and infection.
Okay. So we know rainfall is a real risk, but what about a dew? What if a dew wets the leaf litter? Can it end up discharging ascospores into the air? And then are dew events also a risk for infections?
Yeah, that's a great question. Absolutely, I would agree. Yes, that is a risk for infection. Okay. But it's not as clearly, it's not really a simple answer. It's not really that you have to just have dew and then everything is going to go really bad. There's many other different factors that play into it. So for instance, you need to have certain number of hours that are required with really warm weather. And there has been research that has been done in Norway that has been really looking at that. And there's definitely proof that the ascospores are being released with dew and at certain percentages, different percentages, depending on the weather that preceded the dew. So basically, how warm the weather was before that happened. And also that is also a factor that is going to influence whether the infections are going to occur. So also presence of fog is important during the, and if all those conditions, like a really good weather before, warm weather, and then a certain number of leaf wetness hours that comes with dew, and then of course also fog, prolonged fog happening after that can lead to some infections. And so I would probably guess that in these conditions in that are similar, maybe in Canada to what, they have in Norway, it could play a role. And many times people do forget that any wetting event can contribute and allow, water for the pathogens to infect. I mean, we often say this very interesting, saying that, water is life, and it's true. In this specific case, water is a precondition for certain things to happen in this case as well. But if, you don't have all these sequential factors that I mentioned to you, really warm weather before, certain number of hours during the dew, and also, if you don't have fog happening and prolonging this a number of hours, if they don't collide all, this specific sequence of events, you're not going to get infections from the ascospores. But if you do, you stand the chance of getting infections.
Okay, so now that we have a good foundation in the biology of this disease, sure, I'd like to switch over to some management practices. Now let's take a pause here. Let all of that information germinate, folks, and stay tuned for part two of this topic as the conversation continues. Follow me on Twitter at NSTreeFruit and follow Perennia on Facebook and Twitter at NSPerennia. Thanks to Perennia for dispersing information in the podcast space. Thank you to Patty Ryan and Moira Anderson for their marketing management. Thank you to growers for asking the most infectious questions. Here's a fun fact. When I was in my last year of university, I was in a course on the biological and cultural control of plant diseases. I was given the option to choose any disease to research and write a report on. I chose apple scab. But wait, back to existentialism, maybe apple scab chose me.